Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
By the end of that period, we will have paid enough money into a trust fund to fund marine conservation to the tune of $4.5 million forever. So it will create sustainable finance.
Gabon announces a financial blue bond that enables the Central African country to refinance $500 million of its debt.
We may not love each other, we may not be best of friends, but we have to work together for the people of Sierra Leone. We have to understand where we all come from, and we have to work towards the same goal.
Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio calls on his new ministers and other public officials to work together to resolve the challenges citizens are facing.
I am really encouraged by the enthusiasm of the regional bloc, SADC, to provide the kind of leadership that is necessary in this election. And it is to ensure that we work alongside our brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe to deliver a free, fair, and credible election.
And the leader of the Southern African Poll Observer Mission expresses hope that the Electoral Commission will organize and administer credible polls in Zimbabwe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Several media outlets report that an airstrike on Ethiopia's Amhara region this week led to numerous civilian deaths. Amnesty International has also received allegations of mass killings and casualties in Finote, Selam, Baherda, and Shewa Robit, which merit further investigation. Amnesty is calling for unhindered access for investigations by several independent investigative bodies, including the Independent Media and the Independent Commission of Human Rights Experts on Ethiopia. In Gabon, the administration in Libreville and the Nature Conservancy, a U.S.-based global environmental organization, has announced a financial blue bond that enables the Central African country to refinance $500 million of its debt. The deal, described by observers as innovative and a first in sub-Saharan Africa, will unlock $163 million in new funding for ocean conservation in Gabon. They are calling it a debt-for-nature transaction that will help Gabon's conservation while helping to grow its economy. According to officials, Gabon's marine waters host an impressive diversity of marine life. The country is visited by the Southern Hemisphere's largest population of hunchback whales, who each year nurse their young there before migrating south. To learn more about the financial blue bond, which enables Gabon to restructure its debt for conservation, I reach Professor Lee White. He is the Minister for Water, Forests, the Sea and Environment.
What we've done is we've come together with technical support from an NGO called the Nature Conservancy, US-based NGO, working with the US International Development Finance Corporation, the DFC, and the Bank of America. We've put out a $500 million blue bond, which was oversubscribed to the tune of $1.2 billion. And with the proceedings of that bond, we are buying back $450 million of Gabon's debt, restructuring it, reducing the interest payments that the Ministry of Economy has to make. So we're reducing the cost of Gabon's debt. And at the same time, it's as if we're recycling any profits from the enterprise into conservation activities. So we will generate just under $4.5 million per year over the next 15 years, which is the life of the bond. And by the end of that period, we will have paid enough money into a foundation, a trust fund, to fund marine conservation to the tune of $4.5 million forever. So it will create sustainable finance, which will cover about 20% of the costs of what it costs us to manage Gabon's marine.
Do you think this initiative or deal done by Gabon should be an eye-opener worth emulating by other African countries with similar debt problems?
Absolutely. Gabon, in a way, we are one of the countries where it's most difficult to do this sort of thing because we pay our debt regularly. Just as an example, Ecuador just did a similar deal where they managed to buy their debt back at 40 cents to the dollar because in the past they've had problems repaying their debt. So Gabon is a, as a responsible country that pay our debt, it makes it much more difficult for us to structure this sort of thing. And so African countries that are less able to pay their debt should be much better placed to do even bigger deals than Gabon, because it should be easier for them rather like for Ecuador. So hopefully Gabon can act as a catalyst for other such deals. And hopefully the U.S. government involvement can demonstrate to other developed nations that this sort of thing is a win-win, where we can deal with some of the issues on carbon and biodiversity that are so taxing for our planet right now, in ways that don't necessarily cost huge amounts of money to either party.
Mm. Well, Professor White, a lot of people usually would say that the devil usually is in the detail. Is Gabon satisfied with this deal? And looking at how it is done, will the people get to benefit from this deal?
The Gabonese people benefit to the tune of $163 million that we're going to spend better managing our marine protected areas, better managing our fisheries, to make sure that our fisheries are sustainable. So that's going to improve food security into the future for the vast majority of our population that live in coastal areas and eat ocean fish pretty much every day in their diet. And we're paying less money for our debt. So absolutely, the Gabonese people benefit from this first debt for nature restructuring. Our hope is that we will do more of these sorts of things and that the Gabonese people will benefit in proportion to the services that we are providing to the world. We're the most net carbon positive country on Earth, sucking 100 million tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere every year, but we don't get any recognition for that.
Professor White, what necessitated this deal?
This move is possible because of the leadership of our president, President Ali Bongo Ondimba, on fighting climate change, preserving biodiversity. It's possible because Gabon is a credible country. And that opens up the opportunity for us to do this sort of a deal, which results in reduced debt repayments and increased resources for biodiversity preservation. So, as I say, a win-win for Gabon.
Professor Lee White is the Minister for Water, Forests, the Sea and Environment. He spoke with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio has called on his new ministers and other senior government officials to work together to resolve the challenges citizens are facing. His call came during the orientation process for ministers, deputy ministers, and other public officials in the capital, Freetown. But critics say the new ministers are too inexperienced to meet the aspiration of Sierra Leoneans. The president, however, says he stands by them to help deliver his goal of improving living standards. In the new government, the president appointed a section of ministers who are less than 40 years old, while an estimated 30% are women. Chen Oba is Sierra Leone's Information and Civic Education Minister. He tells me that his colleague ministers are committed to helping the president deliver his mandate to citizens.
So this was an unprecedented gathering. The president convened not just every minister and deputy minister, but also the civil servants. All of these folks came together, and the president had a very simple message for us all. We may not love each other, We may not be best of friends, but we have to work together for the people of Sierra Leone. We have to understand where we all come from, and we have to work towards the same goal. Him and his vice president really broke down what it will take to achieve their incredibly ambitious vision for transforming Sierra Leone.
What were the major takeaways?
I think the most important takeaway was really that we have to find ways to work together. We have to make sure that governments work for the people of this country, that everybody must understand what their respective roles are. The ministers and deputy ministers constitute the political leadership of the respective ministries, you know, essentially champion the president's vision, whereas the bureaucracy, the permanent secretaries and the other administrative staff have their own functions, providing administrative leadership, being essential vote controllers, as they are referred to. And that these nuances are important to achieve our goals. Another big one was we just had people who were really experienced in our governance. They brought along retired permanent secretaries, people that had worked across the respective arms of governance. And we had interactive sessions where they explained how they made it work, what the common challenges are in governance, what the tensions typically are between the ministers and the bureaucracy, and how they overcame those challenges. It was really a clarion call. One of the most inspiring things for me was the president said he was proud of his young cabinet. He makes no apologies for that. And that he's inviting everybody to embrace the innovation and the ambitious vision that he has for the country.
Some people are suggesting that his new team appears to be too young and too inexperienced, according to their criticism. What is your reaction to this criticism that majority of you are young people, inexperienced, they say, and might not be able to have what it takes to deliver or meet the challenges that the people of Sierra Leone are facing?
The president did not just appoint a young cabinet. He appointed a young, competent, accomplished cabinet. Every young person he appointed is of merits, with incredible experience and expertise, with a record of achievements, but he also mixed it. He has assembled the most inclusive cabinets in our history, the most representative cabinets in our history. And if you close your eyes and imagine the people that you will want to lead a transformation for this country. You think about people who are graduates of the top universities in the world, who have patents in their names, who are leaders in their respective fields, not just in Sierra Leone, but internationally, who have the youth dynamism and the industry that the president values. I don't think you can get any better than what we have.
A lot of people are talking about a new policy that you have instituted where ministers will address the public and the public would have chance to ask questions for the ministers to address.
One of the most radical things we have done is we've switched the medium of communication from English to the local language, lingua franca, which is Creole, which we know is spoken by and understood by over 90% of the people of this country as opposed to English, which was the language of the elites. So just by doing that and by working with all the media partners across the country, we have made it easy for the people of the country to take ownership of these conversations. And the other thing we've done is each of these sessions will include not just government ministers, but somebody from civil society or the non-governmental sectors. So because it's a platform for engagement, we believe we should make it available as well to civil society. Last week, we had a young dynamic woman who is a youth activist who was concerned about the drug crisis in the country and wanted to say what they were doing about it. We believe that the governments and our ministry, in our both information and civic education mandates, to continue to provide multiple platforms for meaningful interactions and engagements with the people of Sierra Leone.
Chen Oba is Sierra Leone's Information and Civic Education Minister.
He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Students of the Calabar chapter of the Law Association of Nigeria have petitioned the Vice Chancellor of the school to launch an independent and thorough investigation into allegations of sex for grades at the law faculty. This after the student disrupted a meeting of the teachers of the school during a demonstration to bring the charges to the attention of the authorities. The female student accused at least one of the deans of the school of routine sexual harassment and intimidation. Former students have also accused some of the teachers of being sexual predators. Local media reports that Professor Florence Obi, Vice Chancellor of the University of Calabar, has promised the students that their petition will be addressed. This after the report quoted one of the teachers as saying the allegations are a politically motivated effort to tarnish the image of the school and to expel the accused teachers. Obi Benedict Otu is the president of the Calabar chapter of the Law Student Association of Nigeria. He tells me that rumors of the sex for grade have persisted over the years, adding that this is the opportunity for the university to address the petition.
It is common knowledge in our faculty, especially among students, that the dean does not have control over his inordinate desires for the students, that is, the female students. It should not be surprising that 6 out of every 10 girls in the faculty have a story to tell. So this is not a new development, but an age-long honor he has badged for himself, while he is confident, bragging that the concerned students can do little or nothing to him due to the connection he claims he has in the country. But however, we have texts and chat with them of which day the affected students are willing to testify with enough details as long as their identities remain anonymous.
Since you petitioned the Vice Chancellor, is there a commitment from the school to investigate these allegations?
Yeah, there is a process to follow where matters of this nature arises. So we are waiting to hear from the university, after which we can, you know, proceed to do the necessary.
So Ben, what necessitated the protest? Because I understand that the move disrupted professor's meeting.
All right. There are other pressing issues that are bedeviling the growth and progress of the association. Let me list some of them for you. The dean of law was reinstated back as dean in 2020. From 2020 to 2023, at least 2 sets of students have graduated before me. As at when he was reinstated, I was in my 300 level. Now I'm in my final year. The dean of law have not issued out law journals to students. And these journals are being paid for annually. So the money has accumulated to a very big amount. I don't want to go into calculating that. Then secondly, where newly admitted students are issued their matriculation number, the dean mandated them to pay a certain amount of money before they could collect or have access to their matriculation numbers. Furthermore, where students have already paid faculty charges and are expected to go to the finance office of the faculty to present receipts for clearance, they were still being charged a certain amount of money before they are cleared.
What is the petition asking for?
The prayer contained in the petition is that the school authority should look into the issues raised. It is within the discretion of the school to decide whether or not they keep him as dean or remove him as dean. It is not in our place to say that. So the prayer raised beneath the issues contained in the petition is that the university management should look into the issues raised and address them accordingly.
Some people are saying this is just one of the issues that students are breaking up just to ensure that he is kicked out of the school, and that these are just mere allegations.
when he was accused of raping a 400-level law student named, who is not a lawyer, Barrister Sinemebong Ekong, in 2015, he cried foul that it was politics. He was reinstated back, and he had not ceased from, you know, harassing our female students. There are so many of them that are voiceless. So there is nothing like, it's not, there's no politics. What's my business with the politics of deanship? My dad is not a lecturer in the faculty. I'm merely a student. It's none of my business. I'm only looking after the welfare of the students.
So do you have a groundswell of support for this petition? Because some people are saying that this is just a mere politics and people are going after him because he has been strict.
Yes. If you want to listen to the victim, I'll connect her with you. You know, that is what he's going about, saying that where are the victims? Why is he in a rush? He should calm down. You want to hear from the victims, so connect you with them.
Obi Benedict Otu is the president of the Calabar chapter of the Law Student Association of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Calabar in Nigeria's Cross River State. Meanwhile, a practicing lawyer and human rights defender has welcomed as a positive step the suspension of the dean of the law faculty of the University of Calabar. Attorney Eno Edet, who is a former student of the law faculty of the university, says the suspension should pave way for an independent and thorough inquiry into the allegations against the teacher. Law students recently petitioned the university demanding a probe into sexual harassment against the high-ranking school official. Edet's remarks came after the university suspended Professor Cyril Indifon, dean of the law faculty. This after his responses to questions about the allegations of sexual harassment of students were deemed inadequate. For more reaction and the anticipated impact of the actions of the university, I reach attorney Eno Edet.
I think that is the step in the right direction. The school did the right thing by suspending him. It's pertinent to note that they didn't just suspend him. They had first written to him to say, these are the allegations against you. What is your response? It was after his response that they decided that the matter needed to be investigated further. Then his suspension was conveyed through another letter that said that they were not satisfied totally by his response, and there was a need to suspend him for thorough investigations to take place.
Some people are suggesting that it is not fair that the university appears to have taken the side of the students who are making the allegations, and that perhaps a sit down with the professor to get his view instead of making it official might have triggered things that made him uncomfortable, that led to his letter that was deemed insufficient, that required further investigation. Your thoughts?
Well, I do not agree with that school of thought, because, like, you know, he heads a faculty, he has influence over the faculty. There will be people who would naturally want to come up to speak, but would, for fear of his position, not ordinarily want to speak. So the university took cognizance of the fact, at the risk of holding their brief, because I'm not here to hold brief for them, they took cognizance of the fact that they were careful not to trample on his rights, because, like, you know, their natural, one of the twin pillars of justice is that the other party must be heard. They heard his side and decided that the matter should be investigated further. I think that's only right.
Former students of the suspended dean alleged that they were also victims, and that news or rumors of his deeds, alleged deeds, have been going on for a long time, and that it appears that the university appeared unable to investigate, or people did not come forward for an investigation. What is the situation on the ground?
There have been rumors. You're right. The rumors have been around. But at every point where there is a call for evidence, come out and give your story. For some reason, maybe for the environment where we are, for the fear of being looked at in a funny way, people usually just back out. But I think now is the time for anyone who has any evidence whatsoever to come forth and come out and speak against these ills, because we can do it one person at a time. We cannot expect that the university or indeed the courts would go on a foreign mission to find out from archives what's happening without actual facts, without actual evidence. We need evidence. The court needs evidence. The school needs evidence. So I urge students to be bold and to be courageous enough to speak against these ills. Not only did I, am I a practicing lawyer in Calabar, I also went through the walls of that faculty and we heard the stories. But like I said, no one was strong enough at the point to come out.
Do you think with the action taken by the university and the allegations made in a petition will change the narrative of students who are timid not to come forward, and you know, if the university at all will decide to protect the students who come forward?
Yes, I do. I do believe that things will change if the students who come to testify are protected. I do believe that things will change if even one student comes to testify and, you know, he's brought to book, if he's found guilty. I do believe that things will change. I do believe that if we take it as a responsibility to ensure that our kids are protected in an environment where they ought to be learning and not to be victimized, I do believe that things will change. Turning a blind eye to evil does not make it disappear, no matter how we try. So I do believe that if evidence surfaces from even one student and he is found guilty, if he is guilty, things will change because other students will be emboldened to know that you should not sit in shame or sit in whatever emotions you're facing, fear or whatever it is, and sit back and let yourself fall in as prey.
Eno Ede is a prominent practicing lawyer and a former student of the University of Calabar Law School. She spoke with me from Calabar. In Senegal, the opposition political party PASTEF Les Patriots, the African Patriots of Senegal for Work, Ethics and Fraternity, is calling on the international community to join in the demand for the unconditional release of its leader, Ousmane Sonko. The opposition party says it will hold President Macky Sall and his government responsible for anything that happens to Sonko. This as the opposition leader's hunger strike enters the third week. Sonko has rejected calls by his supporters to end his protest. He took the action after he was charged in July with plotting an uprising, undermining the country's security and having a criminal association with a terrorist group. He denies the charges, saying they are politically motivated, aimed at preventing him from running for the presidency next year. El Malik Ndiaye is the national secretary in charge of communication of the opposition PASTEF Les Patriots. He tells me that the government is to blame for Sonko's current health condition.
I would like to draw the attention of the national and international opinion that the President Ousmane Sonko has been admitted to the intensive care unit at the main hospital of Dakar. So following, of course, his illness and occurred last night. As you can know, President Sonko has been arrested and put in jail without any legal basis. And he started a hunger strike since 19 days now. So that's why finally he was, admitted to the hospital since a week. But from yesterday, he was under intensive care, as you may know, because he fell and he has an illness yesterday night.
So are you saying that the government is to blame for his condition, his health condition at the moment? Is that what you are saying?
For sure, because President Macky Sall, his Minister of Justice and the Minister of the Defense and all those involved in this inhuman persecution, which ended of putting the life of the leader of the opposition in danger, will be held fully responsible for all that will happen. So we would like to say that it's because of injustice and arbitrariness that President Ousmane Sonko is continuing resisting this hunger strike. And he's not the only one. There is other people. We have more than 1,000 people in jail, all belonging to the same political party, PASTEF Le Patriot.
Now, but
which is really unacceptable.
El Malik, some people are suggesting that the party and Mr. Sonko should not blame the government because they have advised Mr. Sonko to stop the hunger strike, and he has refused and continued to do so, knowing very well that his health condition...
Come on. You know that there is multiple forms to resist when there is injustice. Currently, this is the one way that we can do to resist. So we even ourselves try to convince him to stop. But for him, it's the one way to resist. And he's not the only one. There is a lot of people who are in the same situation, and some of them are under intensive care. The thing that we should say is that why the government is continuing persecuting all these people, one political party, the leader of the opposition, while Senegal has been always presented as the best democracy in Africa. But now we are in dictatorship. That's what I would like to say. More than 1,000 people in jail just for political opinion. It's unacceptable.
You said that the party will hold the government responsible if anything were to happen to Mr. Sonko. But how will the opposition party do that?
The national opinion and international opinion will be testimonials, I would like to say. So they will know who is really responsible of the situation. And that's why we call political parties members, the sympathizer, and all Senegalese people to stand up like one and demand the immediate and unconditional release of President Sonko and all these political hostages, because it cannot continue like that. Well, the only thing we ask to Macky Sall is to organize election, very transparent election, choose his candidate and let the Senegalese people choose the next president. He don't have to select who will participate or not. We will never accept that for sure.
Mm. But what do you say to those who are saying that, they understand your call for the unconditional release of Mr. Sonko, but what about the charges that he faces?
The charges, we all know that those charges are not exact. We all know that they use the same charges from the document of Juan Branco at the International Criminal Court, just to put something in opposition to that one. But we all know that all the charges are not exact. President Sonko was not the one who was killing the people. We have more than 15 people shot down.
El Malik Ndiaye is the national secretary in charge of communication of the opposition party PASTEF Le Patriot. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. The leader of the Southern African Poll Observer Mission to monitor the coming elections in Zimbabwe is expressing hope that the Electoral Commission will organize and administer credible elections. Neves Mumba, who is a former Zambian vice president, also says he was assured by officials of the governing ZANU-PF party that the administration will ensure the election process remains peaceful. Opposition groups have expressed worry about politically related violence in the run-up to the elections. They have often accused the police of intimidation and harassment ahead of the vote, accusations the police sharply deny. Zimbabweans go to the polls next week to choose a new president and legislature. For more about expectations and the outcome of the meeting with the representatives of the Electoral Commission, I reach former Zambian Vice President Neves Mumba.
I am really encouraged by the enthusiasm of the regional bloc, SADC, to provide the kind of leadership that is necessary in this election. I think our mandate is extremely clear. Our mandate is to ensure that we work alongside our brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe to deliver a free, fair, and credible election. And We are committed to getting down to work and ensuring that we provide that kind of success to our region, and in this case to Zimbabwe. On the ground, I can say that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission seems to be ready, and they, in their brief yesterday, they gave us a very positive view of how they hope that this election is going to be handled, the process itself. We can only pray and hope that they will stick to what they have pronounced as their vision to ensure that we have a free, fair, and credible election. And we have met today with the ZANU-PF leadership, and we had a very, very serious discussion with them. They have given us their word that peace shall prevail now, during the election, and after. And we have also insisted that we are going to work together in ensuring that we respect the process of the election, because that's even more important than the outcome of the election.
Were you pleased with how the Electoral Commission of Zimbabwe planned to administer this election based on your interactions with them?
Their presentation was well choreographed, and they said all the right things that we needed to hear. There are a few issues that we are unable to talk about, which are in court, involving certain disagreements between them and the opposition. But outside that, I think that they answered the questions we had in terms of ensuring that there is freedom for both sides to effectively campaign and not to disenfranchise anyone. So the talk is right so far. It's the first day. We're here for a long time. Anything can change, but we are praying that, you know, what they said yesterday, they can live by it.
How is the mood in the country in anticipation of the coming elections?
Based on our pre-election team that we sent here ahead of us, at the time they came, there was a lot of discontent that people were not really excited about the election. Generally, according to our pre-campaign or pre-election team that came ahead of us, which is several months ago, we don't know whether that has changed on the ground now that we are getting closer to the election. We are now on the ground. Our people shall be deployed from tomorrow into the different provinces, and they'll continue to give us feedback. I think the longer we stay here, the more information we're going to have and the more accurate we are going to be in, you know, describing the views of the citizens, whether they're happy or not. But so far, I think everything seems calm, and after tomorrow, I think we're going to have more information.
What is the major message to the people of Zimbabwe from the SADC Poll Observer Mission as they get ready to go and choose their next leaders?
First of all, we are telling them to be extremely fearless in expressing their genuine position through the ballot. That they should go there not afraid of anything or any, threats. They should go there as citizens with a God-given right to make a choice of their leaders. That's what we're telling them. Then we have a message for, the Electoral Commission, that they should not even think of interfering with the process of this election, because we believe that Zimbabwe needs an opportunity to renew itself in the eyes of the international community, and Zimbabwe has an opportunity to do that by ensuring that they stay within the norms of international dictates on how to hold the democratic election, which is accepted by the Zimbabwean people, but also respected by the global community. So we think that they should be aware of the fact that the world is watching this election, and let us deliver, both for Zimbabweans and the world, a credible and a respectable outcome of this election.
Neves Mumba is the leader of the Southern African Poll Observer Mission to monitor the coming elections in Zimbabwe. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. In Malawi, defense lawyers for self-proclaimed prophet and millionaire Shepherd Bushiri and his wife, Mary, have petitioned a court in the capital, Lilongwe, to dismiss an extradition case against the religious leader. Lead attorney Wapona Keita argues that the extradition document presented by the government failed to meet the requirements of the Malawian constitution. South Africa's justice ministry is seeking the extradition after accusing the couple of fleeing the country. Bushiri faces 5 warrants of arrest and his wife, who faces 2. They were charged with fraud, money laundering, and corruption. Bushiri, who is the leader of the Enlightened Christian Gathering Church, says he fled with his wife because they fear for their lives. For more information about the petition seeking to dismiss Bushiri's extradition, I reach his lead defense attorney, Wapona Keita.
We appeared before the court on our application to have the entire extradition request dismissed. This was based on the fact that the documents, the affidavits appearing in the extradition request, have not been authenticated in accordance with the Extradition Act, Section 13 of the Extradition Act. How we came to this application is because this matter has been to the High Court a number of times, and in one of the decisions, the High Court it directed the Magistrate Court that the documents must be authenticated in accordance with Malawian Extradition Act. Now, the extradition docket which came to court when we were about to begin the proceedings was authenticated in accordance with South African law. So we're saying they have not followed the direction from the High Court, and therefore they must dismiss the entire application for extradition. That was the application.
I heard the government says, although they agree with the argument you are making, it sharply disagrees that your request of dismissing the extradition should be upheld by the court. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, that is correct. They don't agree with our request, but we wait for the court to decide. What we are saying is that the court has got no option but to dismiss it. The court does not have powers to accept one amend, because it's a magistrate court. It can only do that which the act says it can do. So the court doesn't give the court the powers to go and amend the documents. So we wait and see how the court decides.
But how confident are you that the court will rule in your favor?
Well, I'm highly confident. It's an application which we have made, and we are hopeful it will succeed because it's sound in law. So I don't see why it should not succeed. Yeah.
What do you say to those who are saying they are victims of Prophet Bushiri and his wife when they were in South Africa, running away from justice in South Africa only to seek comfort at home, is denying them justice? How do you respond to that?
I have read the extradition docket. There is nothing to the effect of what you are saying. I've read all the documents. What you are saying is not contained in the extradition docket. So I can only comment based on what I've read from the extradition docket.
Based on the extradition document, do you think your application is justified in court?
Yes. Based on the extradition document and the law in Malawi, our application is valid and justified.
Now, you argue that the magistrate court cannot deviate from statutory provisions, especially that it ought to respect the rulings by the High Court. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that this issue of authentication of documents already appeared before the magistrate court, and the state was not pleased. So it applied for review in the High Court. So the High Court made a ruling on how the documents must be authenticated, and it gave directions to the magistrate court on how it should proceed. So the magistrate can only act within the ambit of what the High Court has told her to do. That's why I'm saying it cannot deviate from that, because the decisions of the High Court are binding on the magistrate court.
So why are you asking the court not to allow the state to amend the substantial flaws in their request? Because extradition proceedings are special, as you argue. They come to court after an order of the Minister of Homeland Security. Explain this.
No, we're not saying they cannot amend. They have not made an application for amendment, because our application is to dismiss the request, and it ends there. What we're saying is the extradition proceedings don't come to the court direct. There's an administrative process whereby the minister issues an authority to proceed, authorizing the High Court to proceed with extradition proceedings. And the minister also makes that order based on the request which he has received. So we're saying the court cannot do anything to that docket unless the minister says, oh, sorry, can you proceed this way? Because the court has to proceed in line of what the minister said that she should proceed.
I'm sure you heard the state prosecutor, Jiko Malunda, telling the media after the court hearing that he believes that the documents are valid. Your reaction to it?
they are not valid. That, as far as Section 13 of the Extradition Act is concerned, they are not authenticated. They are not jury authenticated, so to say.
Wapona Keita is lead defense attorney for self-proclaimed prophet and millionaire Shepherd Bushiri. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Kenya, negotiations for a political settlement between President William Ruto and opposition leader Raila Odinga have led to proposals for constitutional amendments. The negotiations are meant to solve the friction stemming from the disputed 2022 presidential elections. A number of proposed changes to the 2010 Constitution have been sent to the National Dialogue Committee for consideration. To find out more about the proposed constitutional amendments and whether they will work, my colleague Douglas Impuga read political analyst David Monda.
I think the big one is this proposal that we should have a position of official opposition leader, number one, but number two, a position of a prime minister. So those are two big positions, major positions, but positions that will require fundamental constitutional change. Because as you can imagine, when you add these positions to the constitution, you create an imbalance, right? So you have to reconcile so many different parts of the constitution to those changes. But the second part of that question is, it seems like we're back in 2018 all over again, when we had the Building Bridges Initiative proposed after the handshake. It seems now these measures are being pushed by the politicians to try and create additional positions for themselves, which is creating its own problems.
So in other words, you're saying these are eerily similar to the doors in the Building Bridges Initiative that were between Uhuru and Odinga.
Very eerily similar, almost mirror images of the same. I think in addition to what I've mentioned, the additional question of adding the extra constituency to what is already there, I think is a major challenge, and not only in terms of the addition of those constituencies, but also the addition of representatives for those constituencies, additional women's representatives for those constituencies. Now, I say that because the cost on the exchequer, which is essentially the Kenyan citizen, the taxpayer, is going to be larger. The more representative districts you create, the larger the budget, because you have to create payments for the members of the county assembly, you have to create payments for the members of parliament, you have to create payments for the senatorial representatives. And then, of course, remember, every additional representational district has to have its own administrative network, which needs to be put into the constitution and which needs to be paid for. Kenya right now is running a deficit. We don't have money. So the big question then becomes, where is this money going to come from? So this is, again, another big challenge with the conversations that I hear that are coming out of Kenya right now.
Does the political impasse between Ruto and Odinga stem from the some deficit in the constitution? Why do they have to look at the constitution to solve the political impasse?
Fundamentally, my thoughts on this question are, this is a political and a rival problem between two political rivals that they are really trying to sort out through the constitution. And this is a big, big, big challenge. In other words, the rivalry between these two individuals should not become a rivalry for the country. In other words, personality conflicts between Ruto and Raila should not become national conflicts. Challenges for Kenya should really be sorted out through the institutions and frameworks that we already have, which are domiciled in parliament, where we have political parties that can really challenge each other through ideas. The problem in Kenya is, our politics is heavily driven around individuals. So many times, with a lot of these proposals that you're seeing right now, they are really domiciled around the interests of individuals from particular regions. And it really takes away fundamentally from the real interests of the people, which are to reduce the cost of living, to increase employment opportunities for the average Kenyan, increasing the number of representative regions from the current number we have by 56 devolved units is not going to bring down the cost of living. It's actually going to raise the cost of living because these devolved units will need to be paid for. But I think more fundamentally, when we create a lot of these extra devolved units simply to placate the political interests of either William Ruto or Raila Odinga, ultimately, it's the average Kenyan that has to pay the cost for that. But the fundamentals of the problems in the Kenyan system, which are not about devolved units, but more about lack of trust of Kenyans for other Kenyans, lack of trust in our institutions, I think that is a problem that really needs to be solved before we start to create these extra units, creating public trust in our institutions. So when we have elections, people can actually trust the results. When we have government policy, policy coming from the executive office, that people actually believe these policies are in their best interest. That when parliament is passing laws, that people feel that their representatives are actually working to their best interest rather than to the interest of their own individual bellies.
That's David Monda, a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from New York. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how good you are to a goat, it will still eat your ear. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C.